Welcome to Double Take with Matt and Jake. This is Jake, joined by Matt, as always. And we got a very special guest on, one of the best college football writers in the country, Matt Brown. Matt Brown, thanks a whole lot for joining us.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it. I don't know about one of the best college football writers in the country, but I do feel pretty confident I'm one of the two best Matt Browns writing about college football.
Yeah, that's right. I guess something. Well, you're one of my favorite, at least, and I'll let you introduce what you do a bit more, but you're author of the book, What If? A Closer Look at College Football's Greatest Questions. You have Extra Points with Matt Brown, newsletter, kind of the higher level stuff with college football. Do you want to introduce yourself a bit better than myself?
Sure. So for the last 7 years, up until like last week, I worked at SB Nation. I ran all of their college blogs. I wrote for SBNation.com and occasionally wrote for Banner Society. I got laid off on May 1st. I've been running the Extra Points newsletter for the last year, and Extra Points covers all of the off-the-field stuff that shapes what we see on the field. So that's a newsletter about college football history. It's a newsletter about higher education finance, administrative decisions, name, image, and likeness, political updates, you know, all of that really into the weeds stuff that maybe fans don't always pay as much attention to, but it really goes a long way in determining who's good and who's going to struggle on the football field. And you can subscribe to that for free. It's at mattbrown.substack.com. You can also subscribe, and for $7 a month, you can get 4 issues of that a week. So if you're really into the financial side of this sport, you may enjoy Extra Points.
Yeah, and I'm on the website right now, and I guess big picture-wise, one of the questions I think a lot of people have is, we all want a football season to happen, but if it doesn't, I guess, how's that? Again, I told you I'm not going to ask the best questions, but one thing I'm worried about is, like, programs cutting other sports. Is that, do you think that'd be a reality, or what do you think would get cut first if we lose the college football revenue?
Well, I think we're honestly at risk of losing other sports right now. I mean, just you know, 2 weeks ago, conference commissioners from the Group of Five asked the NCAA to issue a waiver for a requirement that says you have to sponsor at least 16 sports to be a Division I institution. And the NCAA said no, but you're only going to ask that kind of question if you're looking to cut some sports. And we've already seen Old Dominion cut men's wrestling, Cincinnati cut men's soccer, Wisconsin Green Bay got rid of both their tennis programs. And I imagine, particularly at the lower end or the non-football side of Division I, that's a conversation that's going to continue to happen. Even if I don't think that's a financially smart decision to make, because if you're cutting an Olympic sport where not all of the kids are on full scholarship, you're taking away kids that are paying tuition and they're paying for room and board and books and all those things that make a college money. If there's no college football season, though, and I have no idea how likely that is. All I can tell you is that athletic directors and university presidents want to do every single thing they possibly can to have a football season. Not having it would be a financial catastrophe. And it might actually impact schools in the Power Five even more than they would outside of the Power Five, because these schools have you know, capital costs for these enormous stadiums, some of which are not completely paid off. They're sponsoring more sports. They have much higher expenses. And almost all of that revenue in some way or another comes from football. It comes from the huge check that you guys get from ESPN. It comes from every $9 beer and every $30 parking space and every $5 hot dog and every donation to get a season ticket. All of that money comes from football. And so if that doesn't happen for a year and you're an athletic department and you're looking at losing 80% of where your money's coming in, and then also losing money from student fees because enrollment's going to go down, and also losing money from the state government because your tax revenue is going down, it would be a catastrophe. It would be so bad that I think you would see multiple Division I programs, multiple FBS programs get out of athletics entirely. And so I think we're all hoping that that doesn't come to pass.
Well, and that's something that you've been, maybe not get out of athletics entirely, but you've been as big picture as anybody when you've suggested some schools dropping football a level from FBS to FCS. Do you think that'd be a possibility as well, maybe?
I think it's a possibility. When I asked a couple of people about this throughout the sport about a month ago, they said it's not super likely because dropping from FBS to FCS is – a university-wide decision that you don't do if you're just looking at two or three bad years financially. You do it if you think there's no possible way we can ever compete at this level and our financial situation is going to change completely. And there's a reason why only Idaho has done it from FBS to FCS in the last 25 years. And they paid a huge institutional price for it. Their university president lost his job. Donations for that program have fallen. And Idaho right now isn't even very good at the FCS level. I think they finished under 500 last year, and they have kind of a mismatched roster. I think it is entirely possible that we see a couple of schools that are either Northeastern independents or MAC schools near the bottom part of that league that take a closer look at this once it becomes clear that the financial fallout from Corona isn't just a 1 or 2 year thing. I think we're looking at a multiple year financial downturn because this is happening at a time when almost every school is bleeding enrollment and when almost every public institution is losing more and more money from the state. So if you're in North Carolina or you're in Maryland or you're in Ohio State, I think you're probably going to be okay. You're a big state flagship. But if you are a public school in that's like the third or fourth university in your state, or if you're located in a city that's losing population, you might have some difficult questions to answer right now. And so I look at UMass, and I look at Akron, and I look at New Mexico State, and whether they're going to drop or not, they have some very difficult questions to ask themselves as athletic departments.
Now, the solution that I've heard suggested most commonly is that they would try to play the football season and not have fans. The idea being that obviously you lose that ticket money, but then you can still, you know, have people watching TV. You're benefiting from your TV deals. How big of a hit would it be to these schools financially if they have to play the season without fans?
So there's a couple of ways of looking at that. And I honestly don't think that's super realistic for college football. And I've had a couple of athletic directors tell me that as well. The biggest reason is you can do this for the NFL. Because with the NFL, you have what's called a collective bargaining agreement. So all of those players, one, they're paid an enormous amount of money. And the players have a say in what level of risk and how much money they're going to get for things. They get to negotiate. And there would probably be some additional conversations if they had to go play football without fans. Because if it's not safe for fans, there's still some level of medical risk for the players. That you can't socially distance during a football game. If you're a defensive tackle, dog, you're breathing on an offensive lineman for 2 hours, right? Like if that guy's asymptomatic and has corona, you're going to be exposed to it. But you can do that for the NFL because of that CBA. You don't have that in college. So if you're a university president, you say, we're going to play football, but it's too dangerous to have fans, or it's too dangerous for us to have open up our campus and have regular instruction. It's too dangerous to have 200 people in a lecture hall. How on earth do you argue in federal court that this is an amateur enterprise, that those athletes are just regular students? Clearly, you're treating them different ways. Clearly, you're demonstrating that the football team is an important commercial enterprise, more important than the chemistry department. And what's going to happen is you're going to get Ed O'Bannon lawsuit number two tomorrow. Like the first empty stadium game is going to be exhibit A, B, C, and D in antitrust lawsuits. And the NCAA will lose, and they will lose a ton of money. And that's why people at Ohio State and Notre Dame and Penn State and Louisville have all said, without really saying it, we don't really think it's possible to play without fans. And even if you do, you realize that's still like 450 people in the stadium. You've got 80 man rosters, 85 man rosters on the sidelines. You got a full coaching staff. You have a full medical staff. You have a full officiating staff. You have a broadcast crew. You can't isolate those people. So just financially, yeah, you're losing about, depending on the school, it might be anywhere from 30 to 50% of your football related revenue is coming from stuff on game day. And that's a big hit, but some of those schools can withstand it. The bigger issue, though, is what that means for the definition of amateurism and what that means for your political standing. And I guarantee that's a way bigger financial hit than not being able to sell parking spaces.
What about one thing I thought about is, let's say like Arizona and Utah open up, but Colorado, Washington, California don't open up. Would there be like neutral site games? Or like what if the NCAA gets cleared, but some states don't get cleared?
Yeah, right now, I don't think anybody has a clear understanding of what any of that's going to mean yet. And they're all running through they're talking with their lawyers, they're talking with medical personnel. And at this point, I don't really think anybody can clearly say exactly what's going to happen. And they won't be able to probably for another month. By the time we start getting into early June, I think that's when schools are going to have to finally make some decisions. But even that becomes difficult because in that situation, when Arizona and Utah are opening up and California isn't, how many kids on those rosters are from California? How many kids on those rosters are potentially traveling? Are you going to be able to test all of those kids before every football game? How often can you test them? What happens when one of those kids tests positive? There's so many variables here at play that a situation where only half the team, the states in a conference are open or allow it, or you're telling these unpaid athletes they can't go home, they can't travel or anything, all of that becomes really difficult and unwieldy. And certainly schools are going to try, because there's so much money riding on this. And if you're in a place like Starkville, Mississippi, or Stillwater, Oklahoma, or a more rural area, your entire local economy is centered around this, right? Like, if there's no football, bars and hotels and restaurants in Starkville will close. So everyone's going to try to make this happen, but there's so many legal and logistical and procedural hurdles to clear, and no one has good answers for that yet. It will be very hard.
Yeah, that, I mean, it sounds like there's just a lot that we don't know, basically.
No, this is the biggest takeaway, and this is what I try to really impart to every listener. We don't know, and coaches know the least. A coach has absolutely no input whatsoever about whether football comes back. An athletic director doesn't know a whole lot more than that. And they can say what they're planning to, and they can make plans, and they can talk about the financial impact. But the athletic director also does not get to pick when sports come back. The university president has a lot more say. But ultimately, this is something that's going to come down to state public health officials. It's going to come down to governors. It's going to come down to maybe the federal government. And none of those guys know, and they won't know for several more weeks. So you're going to see a lot of tweets about schools saying, we plan to open, or we plan to start practice, or we plan to do this. You have to take all those with a huge grain of salt, because all those schools, what they're trying to do is say, please, listen, freshman who was admitted to come to my university, please don't transfer away. Please keep coming. I need your tuition. Everything is fine. You can't really trust anybody that's making a really definitive proclamation about anything right now for at least another month.
And one on-field question I had, one on-field question I had is, you followed Ohio State in the Big Ten probably as closely as anybody, and I think Ryan Day, the head coach at Ohio State, he had such a fantastic season last year, and I think he's going to be a great coach, but there's always the question when you take over for somebody like Urban Meyer, like how much of that is him riding on what Urban built, and how much of it is Ryan Day. So I guess I'll ask, in year one, did you see enough to think Ryan Day can keep that standard up, as ridiculous as it was at Ohio State? Or do you see any sort of a drop off at Ohio State after Justin Fields leaves?
It's a good question, right? And typically speaking, you don't want to be the coach that replaces a legend. You especially don't want to be the guy that replaces Urban Meyer, because Urban Meyer typically doesn't leave schools always in the best of shape afterwards, right? There are coaches that are really great program builders, and there are coaches that are great, program maintainers and are able to build foundations. And Meyer is not as much the latter as he is the former. That being said, though, Ohio State is literally recruiting at an even better clip than Urban Meyer was. The assistant coaching staff at Ohio State right now is probably better than it was the last 2 years with Urban Meyer. And the offensive system, particularly with the downfield passing game, is more aligned to what the NFL wants. It's more aligned to what elite quarterback recruits want, and it's certainly more aligned with what elite wide receivers want. Ohio State is just completely loaded at that position, maybe more so than anybody else in the country at this point. There's always going to be questions. I mean, when Justin Fields leaves, Ohio State has two blue chip quarterbacks in that room, but depth is in a great spot there, and evaluating quarterbacks is always a little bit of a crapshoot compared to evaluating other positions. But at the end of the day, I think Ohio State might be the most recession-proof college football program in the country. Just about every other blue blood over the last 50 years has made one bad coaching hire and has been like bad, capital B bad, for at least a few years, right? LSU, you know, prior to Nick Saban, and Les Miles, like, was really trying to struggle for over a decade. Alabama in my lifetime has been awful. Like, I remember Louisiana Monroe beating Alabama. I remember Alabama being like a fifth place team. We remember Michigan being garbage for the better part of a decade. That hasn't happened to Ohio State. And part of that is because of money. Part of that is because of Ohio State's recruiting footprint. Part of that is tradition. You have to really screw up to go 8-4 or 7-5 at Ohio State without some enormous scandal. So, you know, will Ohio State make the playoff, a 14 playoff every single year? You know, maybe, probably not. But I don't think there's any reason to look at this roster and this coaching staff and this history and their finances and think that a downfall is coming. If anything else, they're going to be one of the top five teams in the country, I think, for the next year or two.
Well, on that note, and I know you're not biased here, but what's the difference between Michigan and Ohio State? Because Matt and I are from Utah. You know, we're not from the Midwest. We don't get to see up close. You just know, oh, that's such a huge rivalry. But why is Ohio State so much more successful than Michigan the last decade, 20 years, whatever?
A major part of it has been player development. Michigan's still recruiting pretty well. They're recruiting at a blue chip level ratio. It's gone down a little bit over the last year or two. But they're, you know, they're still bringing in lots of four-star guys. The difference is that those guys aren't really getting a lot better. Michigan's quarterback play has really not been at a all Big Ten, you know, top level of the conference standard for a while. And part of that is they've had some recruiting misses, but mostly they haven't figured out a strong identity, and those players haven't developed. I look at their quarterback play, and I look at the interior of their offensive line, which is so integral to Michigan's identity, to what they want to be as a football program. They want to be a power running team. It wasn't until like really last year that they tried to do any kind of real spread stuff. And you can't do that if you can't just mow people over blocking, especially in a league like the Big Ten, where there are so many really, really, really good pass rushers. And so that hasn't been up a Michigan standard. And they still, you know, they're still going to have more talent than most of the teams in that league. So if you have even just an average coach or above average coach, you'll win 9 games every year. But Ohio State's recruiting has been at another level, right up there with Clemson, right up there with Alabama. And their offensive talent development has been exceptional as well. And that's why they're putting some of the most players in the NFL over these last couple of years. And Michigan hasn't done that. The other interesting thing about Michigan that they've done under Jim Harbaugh is they've basically stopped trying to recruit Ohio. Ohio is obviously, the best players, the best high school recruits, they typically come from the South or California or Texas. There's a couple other states that overproduce, but Ohio is, until relatively recently, has been right up there. And Ohio State's one of their big advantages is that they're the only FBS, the only Power 5 program in that state, and they generally get the best kids in Ohio. But for many years, Michigan would come in, and if there was a good kid in Toledo or a good kid in Cleveland, Michigan would be very competitive. And under Harbaugh, they haven't really tried. They've gone out west. You know, they've recruited Arizona and California. I know they've offered kids in Utah. They've gone into New England. They have a pipeline in Massachusetts and Connecticut, but they've abandoned some of these Ohio kids. And for a long time, Michigan would go in there and grab a 3-star Ohio kid who Ohio State didn't want, and they'd coach him up, and that kid would just murder Ohio State during that game. And Michigan State followed that blueprint very successfully. And for whatever reason, Michigan's not doing that right now. I think that that's hurting them on the field as well.
Well, just one or two more questions before we let you go. But speaking of states like Ohio, where it's not Georgia or Florida or Texas, but it still produces a lot of players, New Jersey and Maryland, I think, are definitely up there in those states. And Maryland's obviously closer than Rutgers as a program. But because of the recruiting base, is it possible, and what would it take for Maryland to not – they're never going to be Ohio State level, but to be able to be like a Michigan State, like be competitive once in a while in that conference?
They got to cheat better. And like, here's what I mean. Like, Michigan and New Jersey, I mean, excuse me, Maryland and New Jersey, and a lot of cities on the East Coast are different from, you guys are from Utah, right?
Yeah.
And I think Utah is maybe a little bit more similar to Ohio and Michigan in this regard. Like, I used to live a couple blocks from Maryland's campus. When I worked for SB Nation for a long time, I lived in PG County, Maryland. Their home office is in DC. And right around the corner from Maryland, that whole county is full of transplants. It's full of kids that didn't grow up in Maryland. And you have actually one of the best high schools in the entire country, DeMatha. You can walk to Maryland's campus from there. They're going to have 20 Division I recruits on their football team each year. those kids didn't grow up rooting for Maryland. They're from other places. And because Maryland hasn't really been good or interesting in a long time, those kids don't develop that cultural attachment. So you don't get that home state bonus. I grew up in Ohio, and when I came out of the hospital, I had a little Ohio State like blanket. It's just hammered into you from day one. I'm sure you guys know in Utah that there are parts of that state where BYU or Utah is just an enormous part of that, the cultural fabric there. Even if you've never set foot on campus, you're aware of it. Everyone you know is a fan of that program. It means a lot. And that's not true in Maryland. It's not true at Rutgers in New Jersey. If you're a kid growing up in Rockville or in Hyattsville or in Laurel, and you're not an athlete, you don't grow up thinking about going to Maryland. Chances are you're going to go out of state for school. Those East Coast states just export kids like crazy. Whereas if you grow up in Newark or Mount Vernon or Coshocton or Zanesville in Ohio, you grow up thinking about Ohio State. Not to necessarily play football, but because that's the school. And I don't know how you build that. So for states where you don't have that older population, you don't have that tradition in place. And this is a problem for Maryland and New Jersey. It's a problem for the Arizona schools in Phoenix. It's a problem in lots of places in California. It's a problem for North Carolina for a long time in Charlotte. You either have to have a lot of success or you got to drop some bags. And that is honestly what I would recommend. And I think the euphemism we like to use is a coaching staff is playing to win in recruiting. And I think if schools in Maryland and New Jersey and Arizona and these places want to be successful, that's what they're going to have to do, because they can't expect to have those built-in advantages that Midwestern and Southern schools have.
Yeah, speaking of that, the NCAA just announced that, well, they've been talking about it for a little while, but they're going to, or students will pretty soon be allowed to start receiving money for likeness and image and other things. How do you think that's going to be able to affect recruiting and the money that schools are going to legally and not legally give to players?
So much of this depends right now on the rules. And this is kind of the frustrating thing for me as somebody who's been following this issue really closely with the NCAA's announcement, is they're super vague on the rules. Are you going to be allowed as a student to pursue an endorsement deal that is, runs against an arrangement that your university might already have, right? Can you get an Under Armour shoe if you go to an Adidas school? California law says no. The NCAA rule says yes. Colorado law says yes. It's not clear. The NCAA, what they want to do is have a restricted market where a school could theoretically tell a player, hey, that car dealership gave you 10 grand, but you are a true freshman and you suck. That's above market rate. You can only accept $1,000, which might help curtail some of the recruiting excesses, but it will also definitely get you sued because that violates the Sherman Antitrust Act. And that's why the NCAA is going to Congress saying, help us institute recruiting rules because we want to restrict player money and we know we can't legally do that. And I have no idea how that's going to end. I know the government is not especially receptive to that argument. A very big picture, I know that there are a lot of college football fans who are like, oh, this is just going to let the rich get richer and like, oh, you know, this sucks for mid-major programs. And I'm like, dude, have you looked at the 247 rankings right now? The rich literally can't get any richer. Clemson, right? Like, okay, you could sign 25 kids in a class. Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, they're signing 22 blue chips. And some of those kids are going to transfer because they want to play. Like the recruiting field almost literally cannot get more imbalanced. What I think will be interesting is that if you are a school in a rural area that has a large committed fan base, I think you could potentially outbid some of those programs. Like if you are a fringe four-star kid, I could definitely see a world where you'd make more money at Nebraska than you would at Ohio State or Alabama. I know there's been some other commentators who are like, oh, it's going to be a big advantage for schools in big cities. Like, I don't think so. Like, if you go to Houston, sure, there's a bigger market, but that's a bigger market full of people who don't give a crap about Houston football. And you're going to find much more market saturation in Lincoln or in Starkville or in Corvallis or potentially Salt Lake. And that might help some of those kids. So I don't look at this as a really bad thing for college football. I think it's definitely better for kids. And in a sport that has no semblance whatsoever of competitive balance, I think it is more likely to help that than hurt it.
Well, we could. I have so many questions. We could go on for hours, but I know we promised you 20 minutes. We're at like 25 right now, so we'll let you go. Matt Cowden, do you have any more questions, though, before we drop them off?
A scale of 1 to 10, how likely is it the BYU gets into a Power 5 conference in the next 10 years?
One.
That's what I thought, but I was hoping.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, it comes down to this, and is BYU willing to be flexible with the honor code? If BYU came out and said LGBTQ students are allowed to live in, it can be out and in a relationship and live on university housing, and we are committed to modeling our internal honor code off of NCAA principles, and we're not going to kick you off campus for holding hands with a guy, then the Big 12 will take them. If they're not willing to do that, they're going to face increasing ostracization, not just athletically, but from the greater university academic community. You already have some academic conferences that are saying we are hesitant to work with BYU right now because we have gay professors, or we have professors who do not feel comfortable coming on that campus. And it's interesting. Like, you know, I know the BYU history pretty well. This is kind of what happened in the 60s and in the 70s before African Americans were given the priesthood, and given how just aggressively, you know, white that institution was, and that hurt BYU not just athletically with protests, but academically. And if the school doesn't want to do that, like, listen, that's their decision. It's a big country. There are schools that will still want to be in a league with them, and they can still participate in the NCAA, but they will have limited options. And how BYU decides to integrate with the greater university community, I think, is an interesting question for the church over the next several years.
It's fascinating. Honestly, literally fascinating stuff. One of my favorite people to interview. I feel like I'm just in a class I actually enjoy, which was
Oh, man, that's high praise. I love this stuff, and I'm glad there are other people that are interested in it too.
No, definitely. And again, so this is Matt Brown. His Twitter's at Matt Brown EP. Extra points, that newsletter is mattbrown.substack.com. Author of the book, What If? A Closer Look at College Football's Greatest Questions. About a year or two ago, he let me call him for like an hour and just pick his brain on random writing stuff. So very appreciative of that. Matt, thanks so much for coming on. I know you got a lot going on, so really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, guys. I hope you enjoyed it.
Oh, I definitely did, for sure. And I know Matt did as well. So we'll take a quick break and be right back. Thank you. Welcome back to Double Take with Matt and Jake. This is Jake with Matt Cowden. Matt Brown just left us. And that was one of my favorite people we talked to, Matt. That was super interesting.
Yeah, no, that was really cool. But yeah, I think this financial stuff about college football is really interesting, particularly because they're not paying their players right now. But yeah, this is... You know, before, if we would have the conversation, I probably would have said we're more likely to have a football season than not, although I wasn't super optimistic. Now, you just realize how hard it is to have football of any kind.
Yeah, I told him before the show, like, you know, we want you to go in on all this stuff, but we probably just don't know enough to ask the right questions. But I thought me and you did all right, and he did a great job. He's so just in tune with all this stuff that a lot of, I think, college football fans are interested in, but either are a little intimidated by the subject or just don't know what to say or like what questions to ask or what's going on. So I thought it broke down. And he's, again, with the actual football stuff we were talking about, there's just so much stuff that is more to do than football. Like when he's talking about recruiting in Maryland and New Jersey, for example, how that's different than in Ohio, for example. You know, just stuff you don't think about when you look at recruiting rankings, but there's so much, like, sociological stuff that goes into that.
Yeah. No, Ohio State is an interesting program. Like, you look at, Alabama in the SEC can have LSU in Florida, and they have some other programs that challenge them. Big 12 obviously has a lot of competition. Pac-12, we don't know who's going to win every single year. The Big Ten is weird because, you know, obviously Penn State, Michigan State, Michigan, Iowa, sometimes Wisconsin, they do pretty good. But I just feel like Ohio State's going to win every single year. And that's the only Power 5 conference I really feel that way. I know the ACC's probably like that with Clemson, but it hasn't been like that for
I mean, it's only been like that for a couple of years, where I feel like Ohio State's been winning the Big Ten automatically for like my whole life.
Yeah, Ohio State's really had a lockdown pretty much. And he talked about like they just haven't had like a bad coaching hire, which has led to a bad 5 years or whatever. So yeah, it is interesting. And yeah, one thing I was thinking about when he was talking was a lot of people talk about how within the last couple of years, Georgia has gotten on par with, it used to be Texas, Florida, and California as far as like the best recruiting states. But Georgia's actually gotten on par with those states within the last couple of years. So big question is like, what's the next state, the city that's going to blow up like that? And a lot of people think it's going to be Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yeah, no, I mean, and you tweeted out pretty recently a recruiting board that North Carolina had, but they had, you know, really like 12, 15 4-stars already committed, which is great for North Carolina. And then I think they may have had one or two 5-stars.
Yeah, they got one or two 5-stars. They have the number 3 class in the country right now, North Carolina Tar Heels. And it's just, it's such, I think people obviously think basketball when they think North Carolina, but Charlotte, the city of Charlotte's a football city, actually. And then you got people coming from all over. It's one of the richest cities in the country, like per capita. And money always leads to football success. So Charlotte's blowing up. So I think you're going to see, and it'll be like 20 years or something like that, but Charlotte's going to be one of the biggest recruiting bases in the country. And also Phoenix, Matt, there's another area. And Andy Staples from The Athletic a few months ago wrote about the quarterbacks here. But just for part of it is just because it's warm all the time, so you can throw all the time. And another reason is like it's such a fast-growing city, and so many people from how Matt Brown was talking about, no one in Maryland is from Maryland. Same thing in Arizona. No one here is from here, so the kids aren't going to go to U of A or Arizona State. They're going to go, like one of the blue-chip quarterbacks at Ohio State he was talking about is like, his high school's 3 minutes from my house down here. So Florida State's quarterbacks from Arizona that they just signed. Brock Purdy's from Arizona at Iowa State. Like, there are a ton of quarterbacks from Arizona. Keaton Slovis at USC is from Arizona, about 20 minutes from where I live right now. So Phoenix and Charlotte are going to be two huge recruiting cities, already are, but they're going to even blow up even more in the next 10, 20 years or so.
Yeah. Now, how many of the kids who are really good at football in Arizona stay in Arizona? Because like you mentioned, they're going to Florida, they're going to USC. We've had a couple come up to Utah. Whereas North Carolina, at least from the recruiting that I've seen recently, they seem to be staying. That doesn't seem to be the case in Arizona.
No, in Arizona, like the Arizona schools get most of their best players from California. The best player in Arizona this year was a running back from South Point Catholic. It's like 5 minutes from the University of Arizona in Tucson. He went to Texas, and Arizona didn't even recruit him, just they didn't think they were going to get him. And they still get some people like N'Keal Harry, who's on the Patriots, who started Arizona State. He went to Chandler High in Chandler, Arizona. So they're still going to get some people. But for the most part, the best in-state kids go out of state, and the Arizona schools recruit California and Texas pretty heavily to get their kids.
Yeah, that is interesting. But, yeah, North Carolina, yeah, they've got – you know, obviously they've had good athletes coming out of there for a long time because of – the basketball. I'm just thinking about, I'm curious if we're going to see Duke's football program get better. I know they've had one or two good years, but at least from the outside looking in, it seems to me that North Carolina is interested in their football team doing well, and Duke, I don't think, really cares.
Yeah, Mac Brown, head coach of North Carolina, has really turned it on. I did not think he'd be doing this successful, so I've admitted my wrong there many times. But he's, like I said, number 3 recruiting class in the country as of right now. He's just put such a huge emphasis on recruiting in-state. And the coach before that, Larry Fedora, lost a lot of those connections with those local high schools. So Mac Brown's trying to rebuild that up, and that's why there's such a – sorry for the hiccups, an emphasis on those in-state kids and why they're doing so well in recruiting. I'm surprised Duke doesn't do better, though, because David Cutliff, the head coach of Duke, has such a, like, that reputation with the quarterbacks. He coached the Mannings. He coached Daniel Jones. You'd think he'd be able to recruit quarterbacks better, especially a lot of quarterbacks are smart, so they can get into Duke. So you think that'd be more appealing. So you'd think they'd at least have better quarterback talent, even if not overall talent, you know?
Yeah, it is. That is weird.
But yeah, we don't have, we're kind of running out of stuff to say. We're about at time anyway. We did want to mention that yesterday, Miami Dolphins coach Don Shula passed away. He was the coach of the only undefeated team in NFL history, the Dolphins back in the day. So, and I think he's won the coach of the year, from my understanding, more than any other coach. So, I think he's considered by a lot. We weren't alive when he was coaching, but he's considered one of the best coaches of all time. So that was sad. Matt, anything else before we sign off?
No, I don't think so. That's always interesting, you know, trying to evaluate people who, you know, were some of the greats and how they compare to the greats of who are alive right now, just so you weren't able to see them. That's one of the reasons I've enjoyed watching this Jordan documentary, is like, because we were alive when he was playing, but we were also five in 1998, so we can't, like, we couldn't really compare his basketball ability to LeBron James. And so the biggest takeaway that I've had from that is that Michael Jordan seems to have been a bigger cultural icon than LeBron James was. And obviously, it's, you know, very good. Just seeing some of the highlights is really incredible. But it's hard, like, watching that. It's like, well, yeah, but, like, when LeBron James has the ball, I just feel like he's going to score. And I don't know how different that is from Michael Jordan.
Yeah, no, that is pretty – it is hard. I'm excited to see what Belichick happens without Tom Brady and how we look at him. I actually think they'll be all right. I think Stidham's going to be all right, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, so that's who they're doing. They're not even trying to have a quarterback, right?
That's what it looks like. I mean, technically, Brian Hoyer could win the starting job, but I doubt – I would love it, but I doubt Cam Newton's going there. So it's either Andy Dalton – or not Andy Dalton. It's Jared Stidham or Cam Newton. Or, oh, my gosh, I'm an idiot. It's either Jared Stidham or Brian Hoyer.
They love Brian Hoyer over there, don't they?
They do, yeah. So we'll see what happens. And no, I'm excited. Matt, anything before we sign off? Or – this is the second episode this week. This is more than we usually do.
It is more than we usually do. So, yeah, no, I think I'm good.
Cool. Yeah, no, I appreciate it. We'll come back next week with something. We'll figure out some sports to talk about. We'll try to get another interview maybe or something like that. But appreciate everybody listening, and we will talk to you all next week.